Hello, Polytopians. Thanks for tuning into the Polytopian Times. I'm your host, Sam, and today I'm joined by both Razor Z and eSpark. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, hello.
Hello, good to be here. How y'all doing?
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. I know I'm doing good. And I figure we are all looking forward to this episode. It's going to be a fun one. Not the best tribe, but a fun tribe, in my opinion. And that's the Imo. So, without any further ado, let's jump right on in. A cold wind blows down past you to make your ascent up Neely Mountain, deep in the Defi Range, where your next potential vendor waits in the temple above the town of Sopo, the biggest settlement in this part of the range. The Defi Range is the tallest on the square, and it borders the edge of the Chinchi's lands. Both Imo and Chinchi find themselves occasionally contesting each other's claims, although they find themselves more often concerned about the moves of their lowland neighbors. Reaching the Imo villages and towns in the Defi Range can be hazardous, as the trails tend to be steep, winding, and increasingly frigid the higher up you go. To deal with the cold, the Imo have a unique natural bounty they can utilize, Leetbo chilies. The Leetbo chilies pack quite a punch, often called mind-melting by those unacquainted with the people of this high, barren place. Those with sensitive taste buds are best off avoiding Imo territory. Nearly every dish they have is spiced with the Leetbo to add some extra heat. Thankfully, your palate isn't a sensitive one. After another hour of climbing the narrow rocky trail, you finally reach the peak of the mountain, capped with a golden shrine glittering against the morning sun. The path stretches out below you, winding back down the mountain slope until it lands in a narrow, sparsely vegetated valley where Sopo sits. Thankfully, the path down is going to be much easier than the ascent you just made. A few hours later, and you're about halfway down the mountain, when you find the narrow path occupied by another soul. It's a Sun Speaker, a member of the Imo's priesthood class, denoted by the stately shawl and cape they're wearing, with the stereotypical light blue paint and the line on their forehead. That painted line is the Imo symbol for serenity and community, made out of dye from the Isi flower, which is said to improve mental clarity. The tradition of painting the line on the foreheads originates with monks who built those mountaintop shrines in eons past, intended to be a focus that would aid monks in their meditations. As the culture of the monks slowly but surely became the dominant force in Imo lands, it was inevitable that the practice of painting Isi strips would become commonplace, as it now is. The Sun Speakers are more than just priests. They track the movements of the sun for the Imo calendar, a unique thing on the square. The other tribes use a lunar calendar, precise as to the precession of months, but not as useful as a barometer as equinoxes and solstices, for tracking the passing of growing and harvesting seasons. Their inclination for a solar calendar instead of a lunar calendar dates back to the original monks of the mountains. During their long meditations, the red glow of the sun through their eyelids would often be the only marker of the passage of time. Before long, the monks noticed that slowly but surely the angle that the sun would come from would change not just vertically, but over the course of the year, horizontally as well. The ever-inquisitive monks built a shrine, a place with marked slots for the sunlight to come through, that would let them more actively and accurately gauge where the beam was coming from. It was in this way that the learned monks developed the first and only solar calendar, and not long after that, the calendar was widely adopted by the mountain tribe. The Sun Speaker is leading a Llama, the largest animal indigenous to the Imo's mountains. They're roughly the size of the horses bred in the lowlands, with a distinctly longer neck and covered in a thick white wool from head to toe, with the exception of their muzzle, which is covered in a thinner gray fur. The Llamos are the workhorse of the Imo tribe, being the only pack animal capable of traversing the steep mountain paths. Much as with other tribes, Llamos are also used as mounts in battle and as tasty ingredients for their meals. The importance to the Imo isn't to be understated. In honor of their hard-working pack animals, the Feast of Ayu is held annually, with ceremonies and dances held in praise of their woolly steeds. This Llama saddle is packed with chilies and meatier dishes, almost certainly intended to be an offering to the Uli. The Uli, from what you understand, are mountain spirits, not necessarily malevolent or good. Stories are told of them lurking on lonely mountain trails, waiting for unsuspecting travelers to ambush, throwing rocks or pushing pilgrims off the road and down the side of the mountain. However, these stories are also careful to note that the Uli can be sated with offerings of fruit and mead. As long as they stay sated, the Uli are instead guardians of the mountain people, giving blessings unto the towns and villages scattered throughout their rugged homeland. Whatever way their true nature lies, What sticks with you most about the Uli are the ramblings you heard from an intoxicated old monk in a Chinchi tavern, traveling new mountains after years in a monastery. They spoke at length about the Uli, but admonished the lies the monks had been told about them. Apparently, this monk had been fascinated with the mountain spirits and had sought, over the course of his life, to communicate with these entities through meditation. Although he ultimately hadn't been able to communicate with them, he had finally found them in the ether, after many years of trying. The Uli were not what he had expected hearing the tales of his youth. The beings he saw were unfathomably large, looming over the square into unreality. They were touching the square, moving the energy of our world with colossal fingers, causing the polytokens of the square to move at their behest, unknown to them. The monk said these Uli seemed to be changing the fabric of reality, playing with the lives of the tribes as though it were just a game. You found yourself confused by the monk's ramblings then, and still are a good bit to this day, but the idea of eldritch entities toying around with the squares remained unnerving for you. It's not something you've ever brought up again, and likely never will, trying to forget those thoughts as soon as the conversation is remembered. And on that note, you hug against the mountain wall and let the sun speaker pass quietly with but a mutual nod. After they pass, you continue down the mountain in silence, doing your best to focus on the impressive, albeit barren, scenery. After another hour of travel, you find yourself reaching the town of Sopo. It lies in a narrow valley sunken into the DV range, ringed on all sides by the steep mountains. The land in the valley holds the only greenery you've seen so far in the range, light grasses and bushes dotted with lipo chilies, and every so often, thin, wispy trees. The town itself is a tidy place, with boxy, whitewashed buildings bedecked with tan accent stripes at the top or bottom of the columns and walls, and tall, thin windows. The roofs are mostly flat with overhangs sheltering the entrance, although some of the buildings have peaked roofs that resemble mountains from the Chinchi ranges, a callback to their ancient shared heritage. Draped across the fronts of buildings and stretched across each street are countless streamers of multicolored prayer flags, a garish shock of color in this sensibly hued town. The Aimo themselves are notably fewer in number than the other towns you've seen, moving quietly and with purpose when they're out, with the rest, you suspect, cloistered inside meditating. It's a remote place, hard to reach, and these people aren't used to strangers, which can be dangerous for rowdy or raucous travelers who aren't aware of the Aimo's need for silence as they meditate, lest they become enraged at the disturbance, removing as simply and directly as they can, which is almost always a bad outcome for the offender. Thankfully, you did your research before making this trip. Your destination doesn't lie in Sopo, but rather above it, in a local mountain temple where Niki Soto, the abbot, awaits you. It's noon, and you'll figure you'll reach the temple by mid-afternoon if you can keep a steady pace. There should be accommodations for you up there, so you don't have to head back down in the evening or night. You aren't sure how long the negotiations will take. The particular good you're hoping to supply is very valuable and hard to source, so you expect there to be much deliberation before a satisfactory bargain could be reached. If things go well, your trade fleet could find itself furnished with soy, a cream that has the power of healing and which can ease disjointed or broken minds. It would be a boon for your crews to have for ailments or injuries incurred on their voyages. Its production is an ancient, carefully guarded secret of the Aimos, so there aren't any alternative places to source this panacea from. As you head up the mountain to the Sunspeaker Temple, you reflect on how quiet the town was. Surprising given that the Ayaka Festival would be happening in but a few days, replete with poetry recitals, dancing, llama races, and even a parade. It's another sign of quite how reserved and tranquil Aimo society is compared to their contemporaries. That's something you'll need to keep in mind when you finally talk to the abbot, the first Aimoian you'll have spoken to since arriving in the Defi Range. It's going to be a battle of wits making a deal with the Aimoian for something they've kept the source of secret since the beginning of Turns. You believe in your heart that it can be done. And that's a touch on the Aimo lore. So, moving on to resource and terrain spawn rates. Aimo terrain and Chinchi terrain is, again, really similar. So they have the same mountain, forest, and field spawn rates as Chinchi. But the Aimo do have more fruit in their lands, although they have one of the lowest spawn rates for crops in the game, and that's noticeably different than Chinchu has a normal spawn rate for crops. Both have the same amount of wild animals. However, Chinchi does have the higher metal spawn rate, but Aimo does still have a higher than average metal spawn rate, so that's still in their favor.
Yeah, I feel like if you're going to choose between IMO and Chin-Chi, really with IMO, the only difference is the early monument. And if you want, you can go for the philosophy. But we can talk about that more. When do you go for philosophy or not?
So they start out with the meditation tech, which is the tech right below philosophy and right above climbing. You don't get to move on mountains, but you do get an altar in 5 turns, and that's it. That's all it does, except make you close to philosophy. So a perk of the setup is obviously you can get to philosophy on the second turn of the game if you really want to rush it out. And you get a 33% tech discount for the remainder of the game. And that means basically for the entirety of the game, you only pay 33% of the cost needed. And you also get that altar piece early on, so that can give you 3 desperately needed population to any city of your choosing. Again, you're going to want it early on because the IMO has some interesting setups, that's to say the least. Of course, there are some clear and obvious drawbacks. First off, you have less than generous resources. Your starting tech doesn't lend itself to expansion, aggression, exploration, or economic development. So really, it's a tribe that you want to use, in my opinion, only if you're planning on going for the philosophy rush. Now, I know a lot of people have different opinions on this, but honestly, I think it's a poor man's version of Chin Chi if you're not going to do the philosophy rush, and there's not much point in it if you're not in a glory game. Maybe that early monument could be useful there, but honestly, if you're not going to get that tech discount, any other tribe's going to do you better and have better resources while you're at it, really, in my opinion. I'm hard pressed to think of a single other tribe that has worse resources, because the
Well, I feel like the resources are the main thing with the IMO is their resources are inconsistent. So, you'll have one fruit and one animal and one fish, and you're like, I can't pick which tech should I use? I feel like they have a lot of variety in the resources, so it's hard to focus,
I
if that
think
makes sense.
that's definitely another clear drawback, and it's a good call out there. They really do have a lot of variety, so you're gonna have to wind up getting multiple techs too, which lends itself towards the reason to get philosophy, so at least that's less expensive, especially as you expand. But yeah, ultimately, yeah, it's gonna be rough. You're gonna have varied resources, and the sucky part is while you have more fruit than, maybe your contemporaries do, you have no farms to get to for the late game. Really almost none. Wild animals, you get the same rate as other people, nothing special there. But you don't have as high a metal spawn rate as you can get with, say, Chin Chi, which is still considered a pretty mediocre tribe overall. So, I mean, that's your best late game tech as far as eco goes, the best route to go with, and you're going to have a poor man's version of it. They really just, if you're going to bother with them, I don't know if you really want to, because there are just other tribes that have a better start. And you start so weak with IMO.
I mean, IMO is it's not the worst tribe, but it's not one of the stronger tribes either. I think it's a mid to bottom tier tribe.
I mean, you can do some really incredible things with that philosophy rush. It's like, just respond to folks before they have a chance to realize you're responding to them. If you have enough vision, you can see maybe, oh, hey, they produced a knight. Now you've got swordsmen or defenders up in your cities, ready to go block up the front line before they even get down the roads to you. Like, just the tech cost being discounted allows you to, in the late mid game and late game, really do some cool stuff. But yeah, the early game is just a brutal nightmare. Even with the tech discount, and you're gonna need it to keep techs down at 4 stars, while you're getting your first couple of cities and then starting to try to level them up. Because really your first source of population in many situations might wind up being the altar of peace, say you focus on exploration after gaining philosophy. That's gonna come along about as quickly as you can get to it, realistically. Because leveling up cities is gonna take stars, getting the tech first is going to take 2 turns worth of stars, so you honestly are better off exploring a little bit because you can counter the increased tech cost you'd normally get that way, and you get an extra star for each city you find.
A lot of it depends on the map size.
Oh, absolutely.
If I'm playing a really big map and I don't anticipate meeting opponents very soon, philosophy rush makes more sense because you're going to be getting more text and expanding. But on small maps or tiny maps, philosophy rarely is worth it.
Yeah, I think that's an important call out. Really, the philosophy rush is only viable on larger or sparsely populated maps. Maybe if you're in a continents map and you just wound up on a lonely island and nobody else is near you, you might have a couple of turns you could try and pull that off and then turn your economy around. Again, if you get those customs houses out early on because you have a cheap way down through those techs, that could give you an advantage that you can utilize in the mid game. But only if, as you're saying, you have enough space to do it. Because I think the counter to this tribe is as simple as hit them before they have a chance to do anything. And it works every time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think really if you're going for glory and you're trying to get top scores in that, IMO is a good choice to try to get a lot of score. But I mean, really, that's about it. I mean, I like their llamas. That's a good redeeming factor. They are one of my favorite looking animals in the game, for sure. I think their whole look and vibe is down pat, but gameplay wise, leaves to be desired.
Yeah, they have their one focus, and I'm just gonna assume that our IRL version, rush philosophy early, and that's how we wound up with the IMO times.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I know that, again, IMO is not the strongest tribe, but there are some fun ways to play it. There are kind of three different ways that I think of. The most common one is going for philosophy first, right? And so you get philosophy before you capture your first village, because that'll lower your tech costs going forward, and then you just try to expand and you play the game the way you usually do, but all your techs cost less, which is lovely. The other main way to play the game, and this is more on small maps when you anticipate you're going to meet your opponent right away, is to focus on getting a giant as soon as possible. A lot of tribes have a hard time countering that, especially like I've seen it in bullet matches, where it's a small or a tiny map. Sometimes it's better to not even get that second warrior. You just focus on getting that altar of peace and getting enough population to get that giant like as soon as possible.
Most definitely. And if you're stuck in a close quarter situation with IMO and you can't resign because it's a team game or something, that's probably your best course of action. Of course, hope your teammate can help you.
Yeah, that brings up something interesting I was gonna talk about. I think in like a team game, if you can't heal. Like, this is an interesting question. If you're allied to another tribe, can you heal their units as well with Mindbenders? Or is strictly your tribe? Because come think of it, I've never tried that. That's something that, if it isn't a thing, should be a thing.
I think currently you can't heal other people's tribe members. I know, for example, you can't boost other people's units, so I don't think the heal transfers. But to be honest, I haven't checked it myself.
Yeah. I think even if you're solo, I think the Mindbenders can really help out, like, keeping your troops, like, healed up if you're trying to, like, make a formation. So I think it's an interesting, like, formation you can make with that Mindbenders.
And actually, segueing right on back to what we were talking about a couple of seconds ago, eSpark, you want to give us a couple of those fancy ways we can use those Mindbenders?
Yeah, well, I agree with Razor. I actually played a game where I was IMO versus Umaji. And, I have to admit, it was during that bug when you could overheal your units. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. That was fun to play against. I had a friend who would play basically nothing but Simanti, and they just got this really fun bonus they figured out really quick how to use. So made all my games really interesting with like 30 health swordsmen backing up 40 health centipedes, because you just have them sit in the back after getting a little damage and running back there.
Yeah, so what I would do is I would make some riders. I would have the riders go out and attack and then bounce back to be adjacent to the mindbender. And then the mindbender would heal them all. And then the next turn they would again, they would go out in a wave and they would attack. And then they bounce back to the mindbender and the mindbender would just heal them. So that can be kind of fun. It's kind of a gimmick, but it can be really fun.
No, a field hospital is a good idea. And that's kind of a call out to like sort of the mycelium that, you know, the Symantia get to use one of the perks of that trap, you know, like it does a healer right at the end of the turn. You're sort of using the mindbender as a unit in that place. And yeah, a field hospital is one of their good unit or uses, but no, you can use them offensively, I think, too.
Oh, yeah. So you can use mindbenders defensively. basically, you place the mindbender behind your city. So just in case an empty unit comes in to occupy it, you can convert that enemy unit that has just landed in your city. The other way is using double mindbenders, so one next to another. So even if like a giant kills your first mindbender, you have a second one next to it, and then you can convert that. So, but you need them too. You have to do a double mindbender trap in order for that to work.
Right. Yeah, and you're not wrong. You know, like it really, anybody who's played the game for any period of time and kind of realizes what they are isn't going to let you like get them into a trap with it. So you do have to think ahead and really plan it out, do some maybe some sneaky stuff to get them to fall into it.
The other key that you can really use mindbenders is hiding them in the fog, right? You really need that element of surprise, because if your opponent can see that mindbender waiting for you, they're not going to send in their unit. But if you can position your mindbender in the fog, then you can really take advantage and have some fun with that. But you really need to keep track of where your opponent's vision is. If you don't know where their limit of their fog is, then it's not going to work.
Oh, yeah. Very, very good points. Very good points indeed. And it's a risky gamble to put out for sure. But I mean, we're talking about some defensive plays, but you know, I know it's not very common, but you can use mindbenders offensively, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, it usually takes really careful planning. You have to put them, you know, just the right spot. But yeah, the basic idea is you have to place your mindbender next to an enemy city and convert the unit as if they were going to spawn in that city. But to do this, you have to have another unit, usually a warrior, next to the city as well to enter the empty city, because the mindbender itself isn't able to enter an enemy city.
Right. Yes, yeah. And I mean, even if it was in there, it's the easiest thing to smack out ever. And a warrior is a cheap way to ensure you maybe get the city, actually.
Yeah. So overall, I think mindbenders don't work in most situations. they are useful against bots, because bots are not the smartest. Or you can use them with inexperienced players. But most human players who've played long enough can spot a trap and just send in a couple riders and those mindbenders are gone.
Yeah.
I usually try to use them to get rid of giants. That not always works, but I usually play AI games anyways. But yeah, if you're trying to 3-star some tribes, I mean, mindbenders could be a good way to go for getting rid of some of, even, I think they can detect what are they called? The spies.
As of the latest update, I think all units can now detect.
Yes.
So they all can. Oh,
yes. Yeah.
So they're less useful now. But yeah. I mean, you'd still do some fun stuff with them, and it'd be
you still can. It is fun. Like if you're facing off against Illyrian, it is good to take the dragon through. So, or take away those like exclusive units.
Yes.
The one of my favorite units in the game at all is like the ice archer that freezes.
Yes.
That one's super fun. So if you can steal one of those, it's a good time there.
Absolutely, yeah. You can do some really cheeky stuff once you get their special units. You turn on the enemy tribe. Nobody's ready to have to deal with that. And I mean, I want to make sure we touch just officially on the proper counter. I know we said this earlier on, but really, it is as simple as attack them early on because they're just really weak and they'll crumple if you hit them before turn five and they have an altar of peace. They really are going to have a hard time getting multiple warriors out. And if they're doing anything else, like say trying to rush a giant, and you can get there while they only have one warrior, you might be able to rush maybe three units in if you can get riders early enough by turn four, get two riders in. Well, by turn three, get two riders in, and then take a strike with the warrior. You could, if you get the explorer right on a small enough map, wipe them out before they get the altar.
Yeah, I think they're pretty easy to counter just in that, you know, standard tactics. Most other tribes will be able to defeat them, all things being equal.
Absolutely. But if you let them grow long enough to get that customs house set up in a naval game or just in general to be pumping out, you know, mines and forges early on because they can afford it more than their contemporaries, then that situation can totally flip on you. Yeah, as why would we play this tribe? Yeah, it's pretty simple. So you either get that tech discount for the whole game, or you get an early monument, and that's really good for, you know, might or glory, or, you know, because there's tribe restrictions on the game that you've joined, and that happens in some competitive leagues. But honestly, and this is my hot take, really this is just opinion here, but I don't think there's a point in using them if you're not going to do a philosophy rush. There's just other tribes in that same tier that you could choose that are probably a better use case in general. Like,
yeah, I've been asking for Mindbenders to be buffed ever since I've started playing this game. I think Mindbenders are really fun, but in most games they're disappointing, and I would love for them to be a viable unit that someone could actually use in competitive games.
Absolutely. That would just make the tribe more fun, but it would be good to just make another unit useful in general, you know, and maybe it'd make them more viable to have mount healing and stuff. I definitely agree with you there. Well, I think that wraps up our thoughts on the IMO. Thanks as always for joining us, guys. It was a real pleasure having both of you on.
And I will say that I have a strategy guide for IMO that was written by a fellow IMO member. His name's Plant Psychologist. Maybe I can post it in the Discord, a link to the strategy guide.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we now put it out in probably the description of the podcast episode. So, yeah, if you're interested in seeing that, pop on down to the description and you can give it a read. Thanks as always for tuning in, Polytopians, and until next time, see ya!